Game Vertel Podcast. Reflections on ethics and gaming. With Ruth and Robin.
Welcome to Game Vertel. I'm Ruth, and I'm here with
Robin
once again. And today is a bit of a special episode because Robin is going to teach us all about game history.
Yeah, it's good for me that we're doing this right now. We have a little bit of a delay in our regular upload schedule because of, well, everybody knows what's going on in the world. But it's actually really handy for us to do this topic now because all my students are done with their exams, so they can't cheat anymore on knowing all this knowledge in advance. Because at the end of today's podcast, I want to ask Ruth a couple of questions just to see if she would pass my exam or not.
I get very anxious for exams, so I'm sorry in advance.
Well, on purpose, I make all my students extremely anxious for their exams. It's nice. I feed off of it. Okay, well, Ruth, before we had video games, I'm going to start the exam right now, actually, without any explanation whatsoever. And for our listeners, you're going to hear me talk a lot today. So my apologies for that. Before we had video games,
What
did we have? Where did we start off? What was the foundation, the soil upon which we grew video games?
And I'm supposed to know this.
Well, you could hazard a guess what we would have.
Did it have the same purpose as video games? Was it entertainment purpose as well?
No, because the moment it has entertainment purpose, that's when we can start talking about video games. And that's the thing.
I don't know.
Well, in the beginning, and I'm talking actually pre-beginning, this is what we would call Generation Zero, because video game history is divided up into different kinds of generations that each had their own trademarks. And they all kind of blend together. You know, it takes a while for history to develop to really say it was that era or that era. But we had a Generation Zero around the 1950s. Actually, and that's when we divided things up into three broad categories. We had training programs, instructional programs, research programs, you know, in the fields of artificial intelligence, and then demonstration programs intended to like impress the larger audience. So that's what we had pre-video games. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And the first video game, or actually not really video game, but the first game designed solely for entertainment purpose was a game called Tennis for Two. And
I thought it was going to be Pong, but
well, a lot of people think it's Pong, but there's a whole bunch of things that actually happened before Pong. The reason people think it's Pong is because it looks like Tennis for Two. So Tennis for Two was played on what's called an oscilloscope, which is kind of like if you remember those submarine movies and they have this radar that goes on a round screen. It kind of looks like that, except there's no radar. There's a bit of visual noise coming through. And you would basically just have a line like you would have a tennis court, a smaller line in the center that would denote the net, right? And then you had a ball that would go left to right, based off of physics. Yeah. That was actually the first thing that we had that closely resembled a video game, and that was created for what's called the Brookhaven National Laboratory. That's not important, but it was created as a demonstration type game. And that sort of got a lot of people thinking and looking. Of course, in that time, if you were a scientist in that field, you would visit these kind of different laboratories and expositions that we would have. And you would get inspired by what's going on. So there was all these great minds alike that tried to find out what can we do with technology? How can we push it? Yeah. The next thing that was developed around 1962 was called Space War! Exclamation point. It's an important one. It's always there. Space War was extremely popular in the small programming community you had back then, and inspired actually a lot of different electronic games. So a lot of games that you can think that were on the arcade, like Galaxy Game, Computer Space, all of those really early games were inspired by this. Now, it's been said that Space War actually was one of the 10 most important games of all time because it really got the ball rolling. So these are things that play like games, but weren't intended to be games. They were intended more to be like instructional or educational or inspirational above almost. And it's after that we can start talking about the first generation of video games. And what is interesting is that in that time, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. We got to keep it nice and short because else we can be here for days on end. It was a guy called Ralph Baer. Ralph Baer, he looked at what was out there. He started creating his own prototype of something, which he would call the brown box. And his idea was, oh, we got all of these things that are happening on arcades and all of that. I would like to be able to play that at home. Yeah. I would like to do that at home. And the reason it was called a brown box is because all of his circuitry and everything was just brown. A brown box. It was an unassuming brown box. And our company, the Magnavox company, they found, which was a television company, they saw his work. They immediately hired him and they were like, okay, but we're going to put some more money into this project. We're going to see what we can push with that. And that actually released one of the first, if not the first, home console, the Magnavox Odyssey.
I've never heard of this.
Right. A lot of people haven't heard of this. That's why it's interesting. We're going to get into a territory where you're going to be able to talk with me about these things as well, because it's normal that a lot of people haven't heard about this because it wasn't that much of a commercial success as well. You got to imagine, this is a type of device you would put in cartridges, right? And depending on the cartridges, it would do... Well, I say cartridges, but it's more circuit cards. That's how far ago, how long ago it was. And what would happen, it would release a bunch of lights on your screen. And if you wanted that to look somewhat remotely like a game, the game console came with these... stickers, these sort of like things you had to drape over your television screen that would give the illusion of a playing field, and then the lights behind it would start to make sense.
Okay.
Depending on that, it was a clunky thing. It sort of failed to jumpstart the industry, but it was one of the first ones, and it did inspire quite a lot of people. In fact, it inspired a very important name in video game history, which is Nolan Bushnell. Have you ever heard of this man?
I have not, but I want to say that we're going into Nintendo directory.
No, not yet.
Oh,
there was
I'm
something before Nintendo. Something actually a lot more powerful than Nintendo back then.
Yeah. Sega?
No, even before that.
I have no idea.
Well, in 1972... Yeah. Nolan Bushnell saw all of this that was at. Nolan Bushnell, kind of a mix between an engineer and a savvy businessman. I would say, if it wasn't for game design, just for the game industry as a whole, this is the most important man that has ever been there.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I don't believe in the whole, you know, one man type or one woman type trope. This person pioneered
the
everything.
The chosen one.
Yeah, there are no chosen people. It was a lot of people because he worked together with a way more brilliant engineer called Ted Dabney. But Nolan Bushnell, he founded a company called Atari.
Oh, yes, I do know
them.
Yes.
So Atari, which of course vanishes at a certain point, Atari got created. And Nolan Bushnell sort of hires a young engineer called Alan Alcorn. And he said, look, we got this Tennis for Two. We got Magnavox. I'm inspired by all of this. Why don't you come up with something that we could use? We want to release a game for our own new home entertainment system. And or actually not home entertainment system, for our own arcade system. So they were really focused on arcades back then. And this young engineer, Alan Alcorn, he created something in a week that would take the world by storm. So something that a lot of engineers weren't able to do, this intern at their company just completely blew out of the water because he created the prototype for Pong. And that is the game that everybody's familiar with. And that, of course, ignited a whole craze through the industry, especially on the arcade side of things. And that sort of pushed Atari to the top of video game distributors, but both arcade distributors, sort of the number one in the playing field is what we would have then. Now, you didn't mention Nintendo. Nintendo is also around at this period, yeah? So it's not like it was just Atari. And there were a lot of smaller companies as well during that time. Everybody was sort of feeling their way. Nintendo, been around since around 1889, something like that, quite a long time ago, where, of course, everybody knows the story. Nintendo used to make playing cards. It was a playing card company. They are still officially a playing card company. They've kept that sort of brand. But of course, we know now that Nintendo has a lot more going on. Nintendo decided to enter the arcade industry around 75. Didn't have a lot of success, except until 1981 with the release of Donkey Kong, where they got a lot of their fortunes that changed dramatically. And this is where we get the second important person in video game history, which is Shigeru Miyamoto. Surprisingly, they also just hired this guy out of the blue to do some things, to design games for them, for Nintendo. And I would say, quite honestly, there's a lot of good people working there, a lot of intelligent people, but let's really say that Nintendo wouldn't be here if it weren't for Shigeru Miyamoto's brilliant designs and design success. So everything from Mario, Donkey Kong, Zelda, all of that is all because of him. So he got a lot of success by designing Mario, which was originally called Jumpman.
Yes.
And then he went on to think, okay, if we can push the limitations of what we can do and see if we can technologically expand what we have, he started creating a whole RPG adventure game, which would eventually turn into Zelda. So he had a lot of success after success after success. I'm not saying he didn't have any failures, but they were far and few
in between. Yeah,
he definitely built up a lot of good credit with what he does. So we have all of this going on. Around 1976, I would say we get one of the more interesting periods in video game history, which is a lot of companies are copying each other. Yeah. So just like we can see with the iTunes store now, where a lot of games are basically the same game re-released, we get the same back then. We get over 500 Pong clones that were produced. Even some of them were produced by Atari themselves because they could then sell it under a different name and just rack in more
money,
cash.
Yeah.
There were a lot of shady things happening back then. The whole idea of copyright infringement in the industry hadn't really settled in back then. So a lot of video games get released, a lot of clones of each other get released, and the market just couldn't sustain this giant amount of consoles, which forced manufacturers to sell their systems at a loss. And we get in around 1976, we get the first video game crash, which happened. This isn't the important one, I would say. We are going to have another video game crash, but this is the first big financial crash that we have. A lot of smaller companies do get weeded out in this era. And Atari was able to survive it largely due to the success of Space Invaders, which they also released around this time. So we get around an era right now, Generation 2. You see how long this is going to take. There are about 9 generations, though the latter ones go a lot faster. I would say that the latter generations have a lot less interesting things going on. Because we are in a Wild West phase right here. So a lot of cool stuff that goes on around this time. So we have the video game crash, a lot of things burned, and then Atari, sort of like a phoenix from the ashes, with Space Invaders, gets a lot of success. And what happens? They break through with Missile Commander, Defender, all of these big hit titles. They release the Atari 2600, which is a console. And at a certain point, around 1981, the release of Donkey Kong, so the coming of Nintendo, Atari owned about 65% of the entire games industry globally. Now, that's quite a large chunk that we see here. We could even say that around this time we get into a golden age of video games, even though we just had that big crash. It encouraged sort of the gamer demographic to rise up. There was a rise of competitive gaming as well, which back then was more in arcade halls and all of that. But we also get a lot of innovations on the consoles themselves. Suddenly, because you also have home consoles that are becoming more and more popular. You know, you used to put a quarter in the arcade machine, and now you can just play it at home for a lot longer time. So gaming starts to rise up. And with a big rise, a lot of companies start to focus their attention on the games industry again and think, oh, this is a good place to make a quick buck. Mm-hmm. That never goes good.
About all the movie games that are gonna...
Well, what are you thinking about when I'm saying... Because you're thinking in the correct direction. What do you think I'm thinking?
Good old E.T.
Indeed, E.T., which is often called the worst video game ever released. Now, E.T.
Great movie.
Is a great movie, but got released by Atari. So Atari bought the publishing rights for E.T. for an astronomical amount of money. Mm. But because they wanted to release a game in time for the Christmas season, they had roughly 3-4 weeks to make a whole game about that. And it was absolutely god-awful. It is unplayable. It's been called the worst video game of all time. Mm. But it was more of a symptom of the times that they were living in, because at that time, a lot of companies were doing this. Yeah. Companies that had no right to be in video games wanted to make a video game just to promote their product or to use it as a quick trick to turn a bit of money. And of course, the gamer demographic caught on to that, started rebelling against that ID. And we get to the second video game crash, which is in 1983, so not a lot later than the first one. Except this one was a bit stronger, I would say.
Is that around the time they start burying all those E.T. copies?
Yeah, that's when we start getting landfills of video games. There were so many video games, crappy video games, that were being released. Distributors didn't really have an idea of what was good, what was bad, so they had this fate in the golden age of video games, and that fate got shattered because people kept returning games because they were so bad, so unplayable. The video game industry peaked at around 3.2 billion in 1983, and then fell to a revenue of about 100 million in the same year. I would say around 1985, we get those finite numbers. That's a drop of 97%. Of the entire video games industry that gets liquidated. So this is really the big moment, the big
mind
blow.
Blown.
This is the big blow in the video game industry. How do you think the video game industry recovered?
I want to say I don't know, but I also want to guess.
Make a guess.
And I want to look at Nintendo again, because they seem to be pretty outside of that whole movie making games.
yes, you're thinking in the right direction.
But I don't know what they did.
Okay, well, let me ask you the question. If you think about those old school Nintendo games, the cartridges, right, that you would put in your N64, they had something on them.
Oh, the star? Is it?
The star, which is called the Nintendo Seal of Quality. Yeah, and this was something quite smart that Nintendo did. Of course, Nintendo was part of that video game crash as well. They did see their revenues drop quite a bit. And they saw, and this is what made Nintendo, and actually still makes Nintendo a really good company, they saw that, look, it wasn't people's interest in video games that has changed. Mm. It was
the quality
of video games that just destroyed the faith that people had in video games. People still wanted to play video games. There just weren't any quality video games out there. And if they were, they were buried under all the trash.
Mm.
So Nintendo said, look, we got to deal with that lack of faith, that breach of trust that we have with our audience. And they said, from now on, we're going to put a seal on our video games. And this may sound like a cheap marketing ploy, but they actually did something with that. This was the Nintendo Seal of Quality. And what it says, what it reads, people can remember those little golden stars on their video games. It says, this seal is your assurance that Nintendo has approved and guaranteed the quality of this product. And what that meant was any game that had that from Nintendo did have enough time for its development. It was thoroughly checked for bugs. It was the artists working on it were respected, all of that. They wanted to bring this positive influence back. And I wanted to make sure that everything else could be crap, but when it had the seal of quality, at least you know that this game was vetted and you could be assured that you had a quality product on your hand. This strategy worked.
Mm.
Nintendo almost single-handedly brought people into the third generation of video games and brought the trust of consumers back, which benefited everyone at that time. In this time, this third generation, what do video games look like? Well, we get scrolling graphics where you could like run around on screens. This was a new thing. Your sprites, your little movable images, started to actually look like the things they were supposed to look like. And we would call this like the 8-bit era, which means we have a lot more room, on a lot more storage on our cartridges and all of that, to allow games to have some plot going on. It wasn't just a single level that increased in difficulty based on a few parameters. No, there was a little bit of a story going on as well. And another company starts to really rise during this era. That was Sega.
Yeah, and good old Sonic starting to come.
Yes, so as an answer to Nintendo's Mario, even though that's for the next generation, Sega, new kid on the block, decides to take Nintendo head on. So Nintendo at this point had the most powerful position. Atari got kicked off of its throne. And Sega said, we're coming in and we're coming in hot. And they had this whole slander campaign with the Sega Genesis, which was based around the idea of Genesis does what Nintendo don't. That was the whole catchy slogan that they had. And they had commercials you wouldn't believe that were basically a giant middle finger towards Nintendo. You would not be able to get away with that. I mean, you cough wrong in the direction of Nintendo and they will sue your ass. Back then, they got away with all of that. So Sega really fighting Nintendo in what we would call the fourth generation, the console wars era. Yeah.
Oh, we call it that already then?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So we get this console war era. So in the fourth generation, Nintendo with Mario as their main mascot, Sega releasing Sonic the Hedgehog just to fight that ID, just to get all of that. So what was interesting in the competition, you see that Atari is being pushed to the back, and that is I'm leaving them out on purpose because they are sort of vanishing into the background with these two giants fighting each other at that point. Sega really rapidly rising to a position of success. Why did they rise to a position of success? Well, they were technologically superior to anything that was out on the market, also to the Nintendo and everything Nintendo had. And they also decided to invest in more mature games. They got a lot of big sports stars that would endorse their games. They had like Joe Montana Football, which was a big football star in America back then. And they focused on things like Mortal Kombat, which was unseen at the time. A lot of blood, a lot of gore, a lot of dismemberment. So they did focus on a totally different audience than Nintendo did. And they sort of bullied Nintendo with that as well. They made Nintendo look like the children's company. Nintendo didn't mind. I mean, that would be, it would be a big thing to say that they didn't mind completely. Mm. But Nintendo was quite comfortable in that position as well. You gotta also imagine Nintendo had a whole backlog of good games that they could fall back on, that they could continue to develop into next iterations. Sega had to sort of prove themselves and had to catch up to that. So they had the technological superiority, but they didn't have that interesting library of games. And that's what kept them both in check. It's around this time that we also see sort of a software rating for games. You know, the ESRB rating is all because of Mortal Kombat. Yeah, that's why it came in there. And in all honesty, it was Sega and Nintendo fighting it out during that time, and a whole bunch of typical, and it was only that back then, old white guys deciding in America's Congress that we needed to...
Video games are too violent.
Yeah, we can't allow video games to reach children. There's dismemberment in that. Children should be out fighting wars for us. So what they did was they decided to launch the ESRB rating. And they, of course, called Nintendo representatives, Sega representatives, to explain what video games are. Mm. If Sega and Nintendo were a bit smarter back then, they would have stood together and tried to present a good case, tried to not allow that kind of interference in the space. Instead, that whole trial, that whole process was really the two companies swinging dirt at each other. And I am serious. It was opening statements that just devalued the other company right after another. It was childish behavior on a national level that just allowed policymakers to implement their own software rating system based on what they thought it should be, which is also what led to the whole cliche about video games are violent and we shouldn't allow them. Happened because people who don't know anything about video games decided that they were from that point on.
Yeah.
So thank you, Sega and Nintendo, for that. Let's take a quick sip of my coffee. I don't know, is it podcast etiquette to say that?
That you're going to take a sip of your coffee?
Yeah, then I'm going to take a sip, then I'm taking an extended break from talking.
I think it's allowed. I'll allow it.
Wait, I got to... Okay, that's a good coffee, by the way.
ASMR
coffee sipping with me while we're studying for our game history exam, everybody. And then we get into the fifth generation. This is the generation that we start seeing CD-ROMs and all of that. So that means a whole lot of storage space, a whole lot more possibilities. This was quite a big difference in storage space, which also allowed us to get into 3D, or at least rough 3D polygons.
I thought Mario 64 was on a cartridge.
Yes. So they were. You got to keep in mind that all of these generations sort of blend together near the end. So where does it begin? Where does it end? There's no rough dates for it. Mm. These are just big landmarks. We can start talking of the fifth generation when we get the strong 3D visuals, the move to CD-ROM discs and all of that. Okay. So we did have 3D mapping-ish. Mm-hmm. The thing about that is Nintendo did release it in the fifth generation, but Nintendo decided to stay with cartridges and not move to CD-ROMs. And that's why you have that bit of confusion, because while they stuck to cartridges, everybody else was moving to CD-ROMs.
Okay.
This is where we get Tomb Raider, if you need a milestone of what's going on. This is the era that's known for the video game industry's leap from 2D to 3D graphics. The real focus on that. And this is also where we get to see PlayStation enter the field.
Yes.
Now, do you know why PlayStation became a company? Sony was a company, right? They were a big electronics company. But why they decided to go for the PlayStation?
No. He's taking a sip of coffee again.
Another good sip. I'm always taking breaks when I ask Ruth something. Well, actually, Sony had partnered with Nintendo to release the Nintendo PlayStation.
Oh, I have heard about this.
So they developed this. It was almost ready. They had like a working prototype, you would say. They were working on the aesthetics and all of that. And Sony was super excited. They had like release statements coming soon, the Nintendo PlayStation and all of that. Nintendo, in the meantime, in America, is at this big game conference, and they ask them, oh, well, are you going to release the new Nintendo PlayStation, the partnership with Sony? For some reason, Nintendo decided to break off the partnership with Sony like a day or two in advance, and they said, oh, no, we're not going to do that.
And why?
So they, but more important than the why is they released this on a global scale, on the biggest game conference that was out there back then. Sony had just said, look at what we're making with Nintendo. Nintendo says, nah, we're not. We're really not. Nintendo hadn't informed Sony of this,
but
by the way.
I don't understand why they would suddenly go, well, nah.
Quite honestly, I don't know either. Something must have gone wrong. They must have had a difference in opinion, because PlayStation did want very specific things for the PlayStation to make it work, to make it the next generation of things. And Nintendo's always been very strict with their sort of draconian, almost, licensing deals for third-party developers. And I guess they pushed that onto the manufacturers as well. And Sony may have been a bit too rebellious for them. It's not like they outwardly said, we're not going to do it anymore, but they must have talked back a couple times, and Nintendo didn't like it, and then just said, well, fuck you then, you know?
We don't need you.
We don't need you. And, well, this pissed off Sony.
Obviously.
Understandably, of course, because they get stuck with a product that they were developing for someone else. They just announced that they were going to make it for Nintendo, and then Nintendo on the global stage said, no. So Sony said, in a fit of anger, actually, the director said, you know what we're going to do? Everything we can to be competition to Nintendo. Because they were already solidified as electronics giants within the industry. But now they wanted to go into the game field as well. You have to know that Sony at that time had a lot more money than Nintendo because of their other revenue stream. So they just went at it. They entered basically the console war as well with all of these other companies. Now, Atari has sort of slowly vanished away. You hear there's nothing about Atari going on anymore. Atari did try to release a couple new consoles, but nothing really kicked off. They never really recovered from their thing. So Atari vanishes away. And
a moment of silence.
Well, not really. I mean, we get a lot of good things in return, because we get into the sixth generation, where we have consoles like the PlayStation 2 already.
Yes.
The Sega Dreamcast, which was Sega's last attempt at remaining valid in the industry, because Sony has entered the game, Nintendo is in the game, Sega was in the game, but Sega was also struggling. After their strong fight, suddenly Sony comes up as well. Nintendo was holding on quite strongly, and they have two competitors instead of one. And of course, they could still manufacture things. They just weren't the powerhouse they were. They rose quite quickly, stayed there, were at the top, and then started fading out quite rapidly as well. And this was mainly due to the fact that they released a lot of technologically advanced and superior consoles, but they never supported them. So a lot of times they had to fix things because they released them too fast, and then it was just an add-on onto an add-on that you plugged into your system, etc., etc. Consumers just didn't like that. And then when it was too many add-ons, they just said, oh yeah, we're discontinuing that. We're moving on to the next thing. Nintendo never did that. Nintendo would recall their products and release them again for free for the people who had already purchased them, just to make sure that the quality was out there. They always focused on the quality, which is a good thing, which allowed them to remain dominant through all those ages. So you have the PlayStation 2, the Sega Dreamcast, which was the last attempt at Sega to be valid, which didn't really work. And then we get another big player entering the game. Yes, Microsoft entering the game. So What was interesting is that they were making the Xbox, and they were looking for a lot of third-party publishers because they knew if we entered this game, we would need to start off strong. We needed a good number of titles. So they approached a lot of companies. And in this era, because everything was shifting to 3D, 3D games are a lot more expensive to make than 2D games. There was a lot more, at least back then, there was a lot more riding on it. If it failed, that could mean the end of your company. So it was a bigger risk for third-party publishers to develop exclusively for a platform. So they had started to go into multi-platform games. But Microsoft enters and goes to several companies and says, we need a solid star title, an exclusive title, and we want you to develop it. And a lot of companies said, look, Microsoft, you guys are a successful tech company. If you decide to pull the plug on your new project, your new fad into gaming, that's like a small rounding error on for your you, balance yeah. sheet. But for us, it would mean the end of our company if we worked on something and you pulled the plug. So we need you insurance, to show us yeah. a little bit more commitment. Here's what we need. We want Bill Gates on stage with the Xbox. We want him to put his name right next to it. We want him to publicly endorse all of this and go on a whole tour, on a whole marketing campaign, which is what he did. So Bill Gates standing on stage, you know, yeah. showing off the Xbox 360, no, 360, the Xbox next to Dwayne The Rock Johnson and all of that. That may sound like a marketing stunt. That was, but that was Microsoft's ticket into the game industry. They had to do that to prove to publishers that they were serious about this. And they were. And so they got a whole bunch of games to launch on their platform, like, for example, Halo, which was a huge success. Of course, around this time, one of the reasons Microsoft also enters the game is because we start getting the era of the internet that really picks up. Now, we had internet before this, right? But internet connectivity between consoles and all of that, that starts picking up pace around the sixth generation, which leads to a whole bunch of competitive games getting released, multiplayer online
Halo
games.
Halo 2.
All of these sorts of things, and a specific genre that didn't exist before then.
MOBA?
No, MMORPGs.
Ah.
That
I was
going to
say first-person shooter first, but that existed for way longer.
very long time ago. Of course, all of these things already existed on PCs, but now they get brought to consoles. And I am mainly focusing on consoles throughout all of this. You may have noticed. It's because PCs have just followed this trend all throughout, but a PC, and I'm going to anger some people with this, but in and of itself doesn't evolve. It just has new technology, but there weren't big marks like consoles or all of that. So game history is more tied to the consoles and those companies than to what's happening on PC, because PC has just happily been trucking along and doing great all along. All right. And then we get to these later generations, and these are all the generations we're familiar with. Even the sixth to fifth generation we're also familiar with. This is the Xbox 360, the PlayStation 3, the Wii. All of these sorts of things start happening around this time. So
the Kinect, the PlayStation Move.
The PlayStation, the Kinect, the Move. Well, the reason we get these strange consoles, I would call them, is because Nintendo needs to make a comeback, because they had made the GameCube in the past generation. Wasn't really successful. It fell behind.
So many good games, though.
Yeah, it has good games, but the console in and of itself fell way behind the PS2 and the Xbox. Mm. They were a lot more popular. The PS2 was a powerhouse. Yeah. It dominated a whole industry. So many people thought that either Nintendo would quit the console business and go third party like Sega, Atari, and everything I did before, or that their new entry would just be like a new kid-friendly type console, etc. Instead, they decided to do something completely different around here. Released within about a week after the PlayStation 3, they made the Wii. They released the Wii.
The Wii was
and
good.
It was completely different from all of its competitors. The Wii looks like a television remote. They really focused on how can we make it as accessible as possible for people who have never played video games before. And so they had Wii Sports. They had, it sounds derogatory, but it was really a focus of their marketing. They wanted to bring housewives into the fold, or at least people. And what they mean with housewives is people who have never played games before. So they didn't mean specific housewives, because please, let's evolve behind beyond that stereotype. They meant it was a catch-all term for all the people who haven't been playing games or who have stayed away with it, don't know what it is. So the Wii was designed from the ground up to be like a television, like an entertainment system, like something different. And of course, it had motion capabilities. And that was the big revolutionary thing going on, after which a whole lot of other people tried to catch up. This was also the rise of casual games, like the Wii Sports.
Yeah, that came for free with your console, which was also different, as far as I knew.
Yeah,
my parents loved that. They played so much of it.
See, controversial thing, I hate the Wii.
I love the Wii.
I think it's got off. Okay, what do you like about the Wii?
The thing was, I was very young still when the Wii came out. So for me, it was super fun. Just, you could move around while playing games, which for me as a little kid was the best of both worlds.
I never liked the design. It didn't,
I didn't care
right
for the
me.
Design.
Yeah, it's when I was younger, I had a PlayStation 2.
We also had a PlayStation 2.
And
we always had,
I saw the Wii and the motion controls. I don't, it just never tickled my fancy. Never.
The thing in our household was, my parents are both, like, they grew up on Nintendo. My dad got into PlayStation later on, but my mom sticked with Nintendo. So we always have had a PlayStation and a Nintendo console.
Those were, in my opinion, throughout the entirety of game history, those were the two best you could have had.
Yeah, those.
I know. Microsoft, the Xbox, released a couple of really good things as well and has done well. Mm. I just think PlayStation and Nintendo have always been the best.
I now have an Xbox, a new one, Series S, and I'm just catching up because the backwards compatibility is great.
That is that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Well, I have fallen out of love with PlayStation a little bit simply because you cannot get that blasted new PlayStation anywhere. It angers me to no end.
I have ranted
about this so much. What the hell is going on there? Unacceptable.
I hate it as well.
Absolutely unacceptable.
And I don't want to buy... So Horizon Zero Dawn's coming out now. I refuse to buy it on PlayStation 4 because it deserves a PlayStation 5.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, no, I'd rather wait and then screw them and their revenue then.
What I just hate about it is that I know when I can get one, I am going to buy one. and Sony knows that as well.
Are you going to buy the new plates as well in a different color so you can have a different color one?
Oh, no, I never bother with that. I
But it's so ugly, though.
I'm a minimalist, so I like the most sleek or sleek white thing
you can
find.
But it's white.
Yeah, but it's
And I
it's
don't like it. I don't like how it looks.
It looks weird. It looks weird. But I'm still going to get one. I'm still going to get one. I'm going to...
Hide it behind the TV or something.
I don't know. Maybe as some sort of anger therapy, I'm going to...
Throw it against the wall.
Play like Minecraft on it or something just to really push those graphics. I've never played Minecraft, but that'll be
it's
the
fun.
First time I'm playing. Another one of those things I do not understand. I don't get how Minecraft is fun. I've watched playthroughs of it. I've watched people playing it.
I actually don't really play it myself, but my fiance is like obsessed with it and he plays it with his friends. My fiance is turning 30 next week and so he's still playing it and he's having a great time with it and it's fun watching him play. So
are you saying because I'm 30 I have to play it as well?
No, like, I'm just saying that he's been playing it for years.
Because we're old.
You're
this
old.
This is more our speed. This is the type of game we should be playing, just with blocks and the like. None of those action games for you. You're 30.
First person shooters are way too advanced
way
for you
now. Leave Overwatch to us young people. No, I've never gotten the appeal.
Yeah, he
of
got
Minecraft.
Into it from the start, so it's something he and his friends still play. So I don't know.
I have the same with Fortnite, by the way. Never understood it. Never got it.
I've never played it either. Like one or two matches and
maybe
it.
I need to give it a chance because it is really popular. It's
I like watching other people play that though. It's very entertaining to watch.
I don't anymore. And there's a reason. Not
is
that
it
I've
ninja?
Not that no. Not that I've really been watching it, that I've watched it a lot. It's just that it used to be in the beginning when you watch people play Fortnite, you could follow what they're doing. Right now, if you look at pros playing Fortnite, it's like build, turn, click.
But I don't look at pros.
So much going on. It is insane. It's like Apex Legends.
Yeah, it's
way too quick.
You should play Minecraft.
I'm going to play Minecraft today, pet some virtual sheep, run away from whatever those green things are. That's what I'm doing.
No, but I get it. Apex Legends I did play at the start, and now I have no idea what's going on there anymore. They're adding new modes where you can play 9v9 in a control map. And I'm just like, is this turning into Overwatch? Is that what's happening? What's going on?
A lot of games would be a lot better if they were more like Overwatch. I mean, all the hate Blizzard is getting, which a lot of it is justified. Overwatch is still
going.
Extremely good game, and I can't.
I've fallen into Valorant hell last week.
Oh,
is what's happening. Yeah, and I bought the battle pass yesterday, so I'm genuinely falling into Valorant.
Okay,
pass.
So you're gone. Yes. Is what you're saying.
I'm playing no other games anymore.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
No. I never played Counter-Strike, so for me this is actually really fun because it's a lot like Counter-Strike. Mm. So I'm having a good time with it. So that's good.
Well, I don't know a lot about Valorant.
It's Counter-Strike, but with characters that could come straight out of Overwatch.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah, I know what it looks like.
Okay.
I've seen a
they
bit
have
of
the
play,
abilities
but,
and all that as well. But it's very weird for me because in Overwatch, you want to move as much as possible to not get hit. And especially I play Mercy most of the time, so I avoid damage as much as possible. But in Valorant, you want to stand still to shoot, because you shoot more accurate when you're not moving. And that's a very weird thing in my mind.
That feels counterintuitive.
Yeah. And I can't do it. I'm very bad at it. But I'm having a good time, so that's fine.
I'll give it a look, but it's probably too fast for me. I can't play it.
Lots of people who play Overwatch don't want to play it because it's too slow.
Mm.
It plays too slow.
So perfect for someone who's 30 is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, in this, speaking of Minecraft, which is probably the most successful, what I would call indie game, this is also the era where we start seeing a rise of video games, of indie games.
Good.
Mainly because a lot of the internet connectivity also allows for internet marketplaces. Mm. So app stores and the like, where you and game stores online, where you can buy your games. And because suddenly, for smaller developers, it's a lot easier to get their games out there. You know, we have Steam, we have Valve, all of that is coming up. All of that is reaching its peak.
Mm.
And normally when you publish a game, you need to handle shipping, you need to handle, the packaging, all of that sort of hard surface stuff that comes with the territory. Now, with all of these online marketplaces, it's a lot easier. You can just, put your game on the store, you can sell it, and you get your revenue. So that's quite appealing for these indie developers. And this is where we start to see a rise in a lot of indie games. What is also happening here in this seventh generation is that games are being released sort of like major events. Almost, people lining up outside to buy the latest or big reveals at game shows.
Yearly Call of Duty March.
all of that, all of those sorts of things. Games becoming more mainstream in that topic, like accepted art forms, accepted forms of entertainment is what's happening in this seventh generation. This is where most people and most of my students grew up in, like the sixth to seventh generation. There's a really big acceptance of video games that starts to proliferate around the world. And then we get to the eighth, ninth generation. I would say we're entering the ninth generation right now, but it's really hard to say where those strong lines are, because the closer you are to an historical event, the less you can say it's past or we're still in it. We're sort of looking around. This is the Wii U, PlayStation 4, Xbox One. That's the eighth generation. The lines between consoles and computers start to blur a little bit. And that is, I think, a main defining feature of this generation. And aside from that, there's not a lot to be said about it. You know, games like Horizon Zero Dawn, that's what we get here. The choice between a PS4 or an Xbox One, those are the main choices you make. So we'll probably have to take a step back a little bit more to assign some more defining features to what's going on here. Yeah. We have a little bit of a console war still going.
Yes.
But nothing as big as what it used to be. And now we can, of course, argue, are we in the ninth generation?
I was about to ask, because between the PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5, for example, there's not that big a difference.
See, that's what... So we have to start looking for other things. And I think what will be, and already is, a defining feature of the ninth generation... is things like the Nintendo Switch, where you have handheld and consoles at the same time, where you have the Steam Deck that's going to get released.
Yes, but the Nintendo Switch came out 4 years ago now?
It did come out 4 years ago. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah, we're quite close in it. Is that a precursor to the ninth generation? Are we now going to iterate on that idea, that concept, and improve on it? How far can we push that? Those are all the questions that we're going to be answering now in the ninth generation.
I mean, Steam Deck is now following. That's coming out this year, so we might be right.
I would say those things do mark a shift, do mark a new... At least if we don't move in terms of generations, this is a new advancement in the field of video game technology. So that's in a nutshell a little bit what video game history looks like. There is a lot more to it, you know. In my classes, all of those generations, they each warrant an entire class on what's going on. So there's a lot more nuanced things. So I'm sure for a lot of listeners, this is like, oh, and then we move there and we jump to that. And what is happening with handheld consoles? I'm going to make it very simple for you. Handheld consoles have always and will, in my opinion, always be dominated
by Nintendo.
Yeah. They've always been the best at it. Some people have tried to enter that market. They have always, always failed catastrophically in comparison to Nintendo.
I like the PSP.
So, well, the PSP and the PSP Vita are actually quite successful. They were, at least in comparison, and still only a third of the success of the Game Boy Advance, which, strangely enough, wasn't one of the more successful Game Boys.
That was my first Game Boy, the Advance. I never had the color or anything like
that. What is the most successful handheld, you think, to date?
I want to say the 3DS.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the DS. And rapidly being caught up by the Switch, by the way. I should really check that again, because they're definitely neck and neck.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So those are the two bigger ones. So you would say the PSP has entered that handheld field, has done so quite successfully, might I add. But even their success is just a shadow of the success that Nintendo has consistently had throughout all of these. They haven't made a bad release when it comes to the handheld market. So that's all dominated on that end. What's going on the PC side? Well, there's always been games on the PC. They're a lot easier on the PC. The only important thing on the PC is Steam.
Yeah.
Is really, really an important thing, whether you use it or not, right? It doesn't matter. Steam owns so much of the video game market on Steam, has been such a huge catalyst on the distribution side of things, is probably the most important thing going on there.
And now with Epic Games Store coming up.
Yeah.
I don't Do you think that'll be successful or influential on Steam?
That's hard to say. What do you think?
I think competition is good, and that both will benefit from competition. But I don't know, because I'm also a bit... Like, some games are going exclusively on Epic Games, some games are going exclusively on Steam, and, like, having both is just a hassle, in my opinion.
There we go. I think that is what we're also seeing with the whole Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime Video, streams,
HBO Max,
So all of those things. If it was just Netflix, it is widely successful. And don't get me wrong, Netflix is probably still the way more dominant player in that market. But because we start seeing fragmentation again, that sort of devaluates from the whole bundling in the first place.
Mm.
And the same thing happens for Steam, in my opinion. I am not necessarily going to keep looking at different stores. I'll just...
No, I have Steam, so keep, I'm not bothering with...
Keep everything on Steam. Yeah, exactly. So... Yeah, is it a good thing? I don't know. We'll find out. I don't like it, but I get why it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. That's that's game history in a nutshell, like a very, very quick rundown view.
It was not drunk history, but it was fun history.
Okay, so normally we were going to do this drunk.
But it was 10 in the morning when we started.
It's 10 in the morning. I still have a whole day of work to go on. I don't think... I mean, we're in the middle of exam period as well. I don't think I could...
I'm done with exams.
You are, but I am a responsible old man.
Almost turning 30.
No, I'm beyond 30 already. So
turn on Minecraft when you get home.
I gotta get home, and it's like it's almost 11:30 now. I gotta go to bed.
Yeah.
It's way too late. Maybe put on some Minecraft and go to sleep. So no, I thought it wasn't that responsible to start drinking heavily. But I cannot promise to be that responsible because we're probably gonna start recording in the evenings, and then the whiskey comes out. So for the next podcast, we might do a drunk podcast.
For the
regardless.
Next podcast, I kind of want to have a guest, so maybe not then.
You think the guest won't want to drink? I think we should have a guest, and I think we should get the guest drunk. I think that is going to be my goal for the next podcast.
Oh, and a little side note, because Robin hasn't mentioned it, we've been on another podcast together called Bitkroeg. They're a Dutch, like, they're in Dutch, they're not in English, so if you're an English speaker, I'm sorry. You can try to listen to it, but you probably won't understand a word of what they're saying.
I asked to do it in English, but they wouldn't listen.
They are a weekly podcast, and I am normally a regular there. I'm there every week, almost, and we talk about gaming news there, which is what they do.
I got invited once and probably won't be invited again.
They liked you. They liked you.
It's the same.
It's what I have to say.
So there we go. There we go. We have arrived to the crux of the matter. Bad error in judgment on their part, but okay.
Okay. And I think that we will wrap up this episode with no words of wisdom or final words of wisdom from Robin.
So, one question for you, Ruth, from exam. On my exam,
yes.
I ask my students, and this is, I think, the easiest question
I
have on
this
my
wrong.
Exam. Yeah. Why did Nintendo introduce the seal of quality?
Oh, because of the many unqualitative games that came out at the time that led to you, I think, the second video game crash it was. And to get out of that, they were like, oh, we're going to put a seal of approval on this, meaning that our game is made with quality. We've put the hours in it. We've tested it. There are no bugs in it. Everything's okay with this game. So you can buy it and put your trust in us again.
All right. That is actually the complete correct answer. Now, my students have this a lot easier because I give them multiple choice options, but I didn't want to give that to Ruth.
Only just heard the explanation as well. So.
There we go. There we go. So you haven't had time to study yet. All right. I think that's going to be it for this week.
You can find us on Twitter, GFT at DAE. Horrible name still. And on Facebook, just as Game for Thought. And I think on the 16th of February, I think it is, we have a new stream, a new panel coming up about accessibility in gaming. So be there. It'll be fun.
I have moved away from hosting those because I think Ali's just so much better at it. It's a lot more, she brings a tenderness and a care to the quality.
I thought you did good as well.
Yeah, but you know, you don't say no to Ali. She brings,
she's the backbone of Game
there
Festival,
we go
really.
She brings a warmth to it that I simply can't because I'm dead on the inside. So I mean, I couldn't say no. All these ethical topics, and it was just me being an asshole all along. So I'm really happy Ali is presenting those and will be presenting those from now on.
Okay. Well, we'll see you there, and hopefully you enjoyed this episode, and we'll enjoy future episodes.
See you at the next Drunk Podcast.
Bye-bye.
Game for Talk Podcast. Reflections on ethics and gaming. With Ruud and Robin. And Robin.